across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! So the Prime Minister, he stands up, of course, yesterday, and he addresses the country and talks about the painful decisions that his government is going to have to make in the budget, which is coming up in October. He talks specifically about winter fuel allowance. Starmer says he didn't want to do it, but he had to do it. Here in Northern Ireland, we don't know if they're going to do it. Well, that's all right, except if you're a pensioner relying on that money. So will the pensioners who need that money, who are not in pension credit, are they going to get it or not? Is the executive going to means test them somehow? Are they going to continue to give a blanket payment, given the stretch on our resources elsewhere? All unfolds on the Nolan Show this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. They wanted to get back into Stormont. They wanted to make the tough decisions. So where are they? Yesterday we saw the Prime Minister stand up in front of the country and talk about a painful budget that is coming up in October. So what about the local decisions about money that are going to be made by the Northern Ireland Executive, by Stormont? Where are these leaders of this country right now? How galling must it have felt to pensioners throughout Northern Ireland when they heard Sir Keir Starmer making it clear, so England knows, Scotland knows, Wales knows, their pensioners know what is happening to them with regards to the winter fuel allowance. Unless they're on pension credit, they won't get it. Here in Northern Ireland, guess what? No decision. No decision at all in Northern Ireland still to this day. 2 weeks ago, Gordon Lyons, the Minister for Communities, told this programme that he was urgently talking about this matter to the executive. And 2 weeks later, absolutely no decision still. Are the lights on? Is anyone in? Does it feel like that to the pensioners of this country? Sir Keir Starmer spelt it out yesterday that he didn't want to make a decision, but at least he's made it.
I didn't want to means test the winter fuel payment, but it was a choice that we had to make, a choice to protect the most vulnerable pensioners while doing what is necessary to repair the public finances.
And what are we hearing from Stormont? We haven't played the Magic Roundabout music in a while. What do we hear from Stormont? Well, we went to Gordon Lyons and he said that 2 weeks ago, as I said, he said, well, he was discussing it with his executive colleagues. We then go to the Department of Finance yesterday. What do they say? Well, that's in the remit of Gordon Lyons. Round and round we go. Is there a reality check needed for our local politicians that actually this matters to people, that £200 or £300 might not be a lot to MLAs on their salaries or government ministers on their salaries, or indeed the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, and Emma Little-Pengilly, the Deputy First Minister, on their salaries. But to pensioners who are sitting wondering whether they will be able to turn their heat on, whether they will be able to buy oil or gas this winter, is there any chance, Michelle, Emma Little-Pengilly, Gordon Lyons, the executive, is there any chance while this country looks to England, Scotland and Wales at least knowing what's happening, is there any chance of you making a decision? Finance putting it back to Gordon Lyons. Gordon Lyons saying he's talking to the executive. Are they in with regards to being prepared to make decisions? And it's not just about the Winter Fuel Allowance. We've been speaking to the NIO. They have reminded us that the executive is committed to raising a minimum of £113 million through locally generated income. Any decision around that? Guess what? That's the decision making from Stormont. and we're coming up to September. And they told us they wanted back in to make decisions. That's what they said. So what are we going to do? Speaking to me on this programme yesterday, the former senior civil servant, Andrew McCormick, says Stormont lacks financial credibility in the eyes of the Treasury.
It's a real serious dilemma, and they need to face up to these issues and, you know, work it out and get to a place of credibility with the Treasury in London. That's the first.
Do you think it lacks credibility at the moment?
Yes, I nearly choked there. look at all that's happened.
Why does Stormont lack credibility with the Treasury? Why?
Because they keep asking for money, and Treasury says, "Well, can you make some contribution? The 100 million odd that was put into the package of the extra revenue, that's a very small contribution to the package. We want you to pay everything and we won't pay anything. That's not exactly a compelling negotiating strategy."
That's one of the most... He's a former civil servant, but he was one of the most senior in that administration. He's essentially saying, we lack credibility. Now, Anne Watson is with us this morning. Anne's a member of the Older People's Parliament. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning.
So the pensioners, at least they know what's happening in England, Scotland and Wales. Are the lights on here? Are pensioners going to be told, what, a day before they're supposed to get it?
Do you expect them to come back from their holidays? Because there's a tragedy happening to the older people. They're not one bit interested in the older people. They're more interested in doing bigger and better things so people can say how wonderful they are. But the fact that older people are going to be the ones that suffer, and we're the first ones that he kicked. And I said that the last time it was on, because we're an easy target.
But we don't know that it's happening here. The executive may make a decision. Gordon Lyons, the communities minister, may make a decision. No, it's not going to happen on his watch. But where is the decision?
How likely do you think that is to happen? And in the late news last night, Northern Ireland was included in it.
Northern Ireland's not included in it. It's not.
I know that. But on the late news last night, it said it. The English news. We were included in it because I was watching it. And I was quite surprised when I heard them say it. And I looked at the screen and then the writing was up and Northern Ireland was included in it.
Well, it's not
and
true,
said,
right?
No, that's not right.
So it's a local decision here. And if we remind ourselves, the local executive at the time, they chose to make a different decision around bedroom tax, for example. Do you remember? That's
yep.
what they did. That's why you have Stormont, to make local decisions. Where is it? Where's the decision?
Well, they not come back from their holidays now. Sure, there's only a few days to go. What difference would it make?
How come there's a decision in the summer break for England, Scotland and Wales? Why not here? And Minister Lyons said he was urgently speaking to the executive. That was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, you couldn't believe a word any of them say. Because they can say one thing today and tomorrow they'll change their mind and say, have to do something different about that. He has already warned us what the budget's going to be like and how many other people are going to be kicked in the budget.
Well, so again, you have a Prime Minister of the United Kingdom talking about how painful the budget, which comes in October, is going to be. There are other what-ifs that apply to Northern Ireland. So people will be caught by that budget. But there are then what-ifs. For example, that 113 million that Stormont is supposed to raise, they're going to raise some of that, most of that, through rates going up. But what other revenue-raising measures, difficult decisions, tough decisions, are they going to make? And if they're not going to revenue raise, then can they tell us what public services they're going to cut? The mess that we have with education, with health, with our policing budget, is there anybody actually in there with the lights on, sitting down, working out how Northern Ireland's going to function?
Well, I can tell you the older people will not have the lights on because they'll not be able to afford to put them on because they'll have no money to pay for the things. And if anything more that affects older people in the budget, how much, what are they going to do then? It's really crazy. This man just told everybody how wonderful he was, and hey, vote for us. We will do this, we will do that, we will do the other thing. First thing he done was kick the pensioners.
But the executive can protect the pensioners here if they choose to make that decision. This is the point.
Yeah. They were more happy to get a rise in wages when they weren't even working. So how much do you think they're going to worry about the pensioners?
Well, they actually got a pay cut when they weren't working.
That's because they weren't working, but they got an official rise in wages because it went through. They only got a portion of it because they weren't working, but they still got money, nevertheless.
Look, what I'm trying to represent today are the questions that very well may be on the mind of people that do not have a lot of savings. There will be a cohort of people listening to the Nolan Show today, and they've got enough money in the bank that whatever decision is made this winter, they're going to be warm, they're going to be fed, their kids are going to get to school with new school uniforms, it ain't going to be a problem. There is another cohort of people, young, middle-aged and old, and whatever decision Stormont makes could be the difference from them being comfortable and them being in trouble this winter. And yet they're not being given time.
Even if they did have the time, where are they going to save it from? They use it very marginally now. I can hear among my friends, a couple of nights there was quite cool, and they were horrified. I had to put the heating on for an hour last night because it was so cold. An hour, and that was it. Because they're afraid to put it on because of what it's going to cost and what could be in front of them.
Peter's in Derry. Morning, Peter.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, sir.
When you look at the figures that are being bandied about by the Labour Party, I mean, they're spending $6.4 million on immigration policies, half of probably a good proportion of which is running up and down the channel using various boats and various things to try and stop something which they can't prevent. And they're wasting their time and all this stuff just to suit the Brexiters. I mean, at the end of the day, and when you look at the other figure, what would it cost for the government to pay out on winter fuel heating allowance this year? The Quagga quota was $1.6 billion. So you compare that. That's only a quarter of the six.
That's right, the whole of the UK. Well, John Campbell's coming on in a wee minute, and he'll tell us, hopefully, what it would cost here in Northern Ireland. But I was waiting, Peter, right? Here's what I was doing yesterday. I was watching the Prime Minister speaking while I was sitting in this studio at 10 o'clock. And I was wondering to myself, OK, is there going to be a local version of this? Is Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly, knowing that the Prime Minister's talking about a painful budget for the UK, are we going to have our local leaders here in Northern Ireland standing in front of us? Is that going to be later in the day? Was that going to be yesterday afternoon? Was that going to be this morning? Diddly squat. Nothing. Where are these people? I don't know if they're on their holidays or not, but there are deputies and there are other ministers and there is an executive office and we have leaders of this country. Do they get it that this must be scary for people listening to Stormer yesterday? Where are our local leaders telling us about the implications for us of the decisions they make, Peter, or they're about to make?
Well, you see, look, you listen to Michelle O'Neill, you listen to Tangeli, you listen to them all, they're all virtue signaling, taking up issues like transgender rights, which is perfectly acceptable. But at this time when pensioners, the priority should be, when pensioners are going to be starving, they're going to be, as Keir Starmer quoted the case in England of an old lady of 84 who spends most of her day in bed and doesn't get out of bed. I mean, because she can't afford to put on the heat, and then she wears some sort of a type of blanket thing over the rest of the day to avoid switching it up and turning it up. I mean, that is unacceptable, Stephen. That is absolutely, in this day and age, in the year 2024, it's obscene. And I, as a member, just previous member of the Liberal Party, foresee this as the worst self-infliction by the Liberal Party, if they're talking about a second term, it's not going to happen. There's going to be a landslide, or at least a comfortable majority, for the Lib Dems in the next election. That's what I'm forecasting. And I'll tell you what, Northern Ireland, Lib Dems and all, it doesn't matter, because they're working with one arm strapped behind the back because of a very limited budget they're given. Can't perform miracles.
You're talking about UK politics, and that is part of the story, absolutely, given what the Prime Minister said yesterday. But our local leaders here in Northern Ireland, 15th of August, this is now the 28th, 15th of August, Gordon Lyon said the following: the Chancellor's decision to restrict the winter fuel payment to those on pension credit and other means-tested benefits only is disappointing news, which will create an additional financial burden for those senior citizens who are less well off. I will be discussing this matter with my executive colleagues as a matter of urgency. So that's what Minister Lyon said 13 days ago. 13 days later, what does finance tell us when we go to them? We say, any movement? They say, well, it's within Gordon Lyon's remit. And round we go, and it's funny, except if you are a pensioner or somebody that needs to know if they're getting this money this autumn. Is there anybody in our executive prepared to make decisions soon? Our business economics editor, John Campbell, with us this morning. So, Sir Keir Starmer, in that garden, that beautiful garden, the Rose Garden, giving some not very beautiful news yesterday about what's coming up in the autumn budget.
Yeah, to be honest, he didn't really tell us very much that we didn't really
except
know.
It's going to be painful.
Yeah, but I think we already knew that anyway. So there was no real policy there. You know, we don't know what tax measures are going to be looked at or used. All we heard was this continuing political point, which Labour have made and will continue to make up to the budget and beyond, which is they've been left with a pretty terrible inheritance in public services from the last government, and that fixing that is going to be difficult and expensive, and it will take time. And he suggested that there are going to be tax rises, but we know that he's ruled out increasing income tax, national insurance, VAT and corporation tax, which is most of the sources of government revenues, which leaves him with limited places where he can increase taxes.
Leaves him with capital gains tax, inheritance tax, doesn't it? And possible changes to pension rules.
Yeah, so basically, if you like, rich people taxes, so or South East of England people taxes is how you might think of them, for inheritance tax. Hardly anybody in Northern Ireland pays inheritance tax. It's like, I think, maybe a couple of hundred estates a year will actually have any inheritance tax charged. Capital gains tax is the tax you pay when you're selling something like a second house or shares which you don't hold in an ISA, or probably the bigger issue there, it's the tax you pay when you're selling a business, so which could be of worry to people who maybe have a reasonably small business and are hoping to really make any real money when they cash that out. And then there's also a tax benefit that you get as a higher earner when you're saving into your pension, and there's a possibility they could make that less generous. So those are probably the areas which Keir Starmer is looking at. None of those is going to raise hugely transformational amounts of money, because the only real way you would get transformationally big amounts of money is to look at those other taxes, particularly income tax and national insurance. The other thing the Chancellor could do is just around the bands where you start paying income tax. So you start paying income tax when you have earnings of about £12,500, and then there's the higher rate and additional rate. Those bands, generally what happens is they move up with inflation. So as you get a pay rise, it means that in percentage terms you're paying about the same amount of tax. The last government froze those bands, and it's possible that the Chancellor will continue that freeze. So that wouldn't raise more money immediately, but over the course of this Parliament it would bring in quite a bit more money.
Given the financial pressure the local executive is under, and we have the NIO reminding us this morning, John, that the executive is committed to raising a minimum of 113 million. Now, finance are telling us that 80 million of that should be raised through other measures, and I think that's rates, isn't it? Is it conceivable that Gordon Lyons and the executive could afford, unlike England, Scotland and Wales, to not make changes to the winter fuel allowance? Is it likely?
I think it would be quite difficult for them, given everything we've heard about the state of public services just over the last couple of weeks, you know, education, policing, health, housing, you name it. There are so many demands. So would, say, for example, if I've seen a figure of £70 million maybe put against keeping the winter fuel allowance in Northern Ireland.
How much?
£70 million has been suggested. So if you look across everything, and obviously that would be a recurring cost and an open-ended cost, if you look across all the challenges which Stormont has, would you say the universal benefit for pensioners is the number one priority? Particularly when you know, pensioners have really been a protected species under the last government, you know, with the triple lock and all the rest of it.
So I'm hearing from some of our callers, John, oh, the politicians are on holiday, and they're not all on holiday. Some of them are, some of them are not. How come there has been a definitive decision being able to be relayed to the pensioners for England, Scotland and Wales, but not Northern Ireland? Presumably the politicians across the water go on holiday too. What is the delay here?
Well, we have a rather different system of government, where I think for a decision of like this, you'd ultimately, you're going to need agreement across the executive, because of the way our government is formulated. Those sorts of potentially controversial decisions just take more time. You know, for the UK government in particular, pretty much the Chancellor and the Prime Minister can just say, this is it, it's happening. But because here we have this compulsory coalition, if you like, a decision like this one is going to be a bit trickier. So I don't know if they're trying to work on something where they could be able to shape a decision which would allow them to do something different from the rest of the UK, or whether it's just they're working out how they communicate this and what exactly they do with it. So we don't know for sure, but I think that just the structural difference in our government is going to be part of
it. When's the payment due?
I don't know.
Probably this autumn, I would guess, with winter fuel payment. Yeah. We'll check it out. John, thank you. Morning to you. Tom in Banbridge. Morning, Tom.
Hi, Brian Stephen.
Go ahead, sir.
Poor Great Britain. No money. How much money was sent in foreign aid in the last 6 months? How much money has it cost for immigrants? I'm not criticising them, I'm criticising the government. 8 million a day.
So you're against foreign aid, Tom, are you?
I'm against foreign aid,
you're,
surely.
You're against providing money so that people don't starve to death.
Look, typical Stephen Nolan, good morning to you and goodbye. I never listen to you. I only listen to it about 5 minutes every morning.
I'm just raising a question, Tom, about whether in a developed country...
I'm talking about Great Britain.
Yes, but
I'm not talking about people in foreign countries that are starving.
Well, that's what foreign aid is, Tom.
They deserve every penny
that
their country can...
Tom, hear me out. Hear me out here. That's what foreign aid is. So it's not just some abstract discussion on a radio programme like this between you and I. Tom, foreign aid is about a country giving money to people who are starving to death.
We can't afford it. Our pensioners are going to be... I'm in a good position where I have a good family, and I won't be not putting my oil in the tank. I have a great family, and they look after us 100%. I'm talking about other pensioners who I know well, in Banbridge in particular, and they could be dealing with the allowance for their oil and their fuel, whatever they use.
Okay.
And I'm telling you now, you have to look at how much... illegal immigrants they can afford to do without torturing pensioners who are not relying, right, they bring in so much and they're getting so much.
Well, look, Tom.
There's a lot of pensioners actually need it, and because they've saved and got a few pound in their pension, like I have, they're just on the line.
Well, Tom,
they need that lock of pound.
Can I say to you, thank you for staying on and talking to me, and at least we've had a conversation, so thank you, sir. Douglas in Hillsborough. Morning, Douglas.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead. You're 86.
Stephen, the first thing us pensioners lost was their TV licence, right?
Yeah.
The next thing is going to be, and there's no doubt about it, we lose this heating and lunch.
Well, there is a doubt about it, because Starbuck won't tell you.
Well, was that a minister was on there?
No, that was our BBC economics correspondent, John Campbell.
Well, John Campbell, the heating allowance is November. You get your money in November into the bank. So you do.
Well, this is our point. Our point is, people like you, presumably, and others, you're waiting for this money.
I'm nearly 6 years of age.
You're waiting on this money. You, at the minute, you haven't been told whether or not you're getting it in November. Has Stormont got, have these political parties got any realisation the impact that has on elderly people who two months out, they don't know whether they're getting it or not?
Yes, but they're saying that people on pension credit are going to get it.
Well, that's the policy across the water.
Yes. Well, pension credit is somebody who hasn't worked hardly all their days because of no stamps to get pension. So their pension is made up. And when they get their pension made up, they're entitled to everything. TV license, dental treatment, everything. But us pensioners who have worked all our days, we are going to get nothing.
Well, you don't know that. That's up to Gordon Lyons, the Communities Minister. That's up. He says he's discussing it with executive colleagues as a matter of urgency. 13 days he said that. So if it's a matter of urgency, what has his executive colleagues said back to him?
Well, you've only 6 weeks or so you have until they start paying this money out. So it is.
If they're going to pay it. And can they afford to pay it if the policing budget's screwed, if the health budget needs more money, if education needs more money? Do you hand money to pensioners who don't need it? Some do, some don't.
It is, it's 70 million, so it is, according to John Campbell, for the pay pensioners their winter allowance.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
What did it cost for the police 5 days of ratting?
Say again, Douglas?
It will cost 70 million for the pay the pensioners are heating allowance. What did it cost for 5 days ratting here in Northern Ireland?
Well,
wasn't it one point something?
Well, talk to the riders.
Pardon?
Talk to the riders. That's the people that go out, wrecking ruin, and don't give a damn about their community.
They were able to get money for that, so they were.
Well, they weren't. Because vouchers, that's a cost to the policing budget. And vouchers already saying he doesn't have enough money for policing here. The Permanent Secretary, Hugh Wittes, is warning him that he'll intervene if he doesn't. This country needs decisions made. Where's the programme for government, for example?
Well, the point about it is, you take everything that's going on, it's all public sector. All public sector. What about the private sector? Private sector at the moment is making money.
Okay, Douglas, thank you very much. 030 30 80 55 55. We'll pause there. Let's get the news from the BBC. Former Director of Communications for the Ulster Unionist Party, Alex Kane, is with us this morning. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Stephen.
If we want to continue to pay the pensioners in Northern Ireland who do not get pension credit, so what Starmer has done, and how it's going to apply in England, Scotland and Wales, is it will only be those pensioners who are on pension credit who will get the winter fuel allowance. If Stormont decide no, they're going to do it different, they're going to continue to give the money to all pensioners, that will cost Northern Ireland 70 million. This programme's point this morning, Alex, is that there will be people in that cohort of not knowing whether they're going to get it or not, who will have to make changes to their lifestyle in order to be able to turn the heating on. Where are these people who are our elected representatives? Where's the decisions, Alex?
Well, you know, so let's be honest, Stephen, it's more or less what it's been forever. I mean, 4 months' time, just bear this in mind, in 4 months' time, we will be marking the 25th anniversary of the first meeting of the first executive in Northern Ireland. And the problems that were set out back then still apply now, Stephen. And do you know what the heart of it, I suspect, and you talk about they don't want to make executive cuts, they don't want to make decisions and so on. At the back of their thinking, and I think Andrew McCormick may have touched upon it in previous interviews with you, the back of their minds is this view that somehow Northern Ireland can still be seen as, if you like, exceptional status circumstances. That things will always be bad. They'll always be able to say, oh, to keep the peace process going, to keep the executive going, to keep politics going, you need to help us out here. And the problem is, Stephen, they are not taken seriously, because even as I've said to you before, even if the Treasury was to say, look, we know you're in trouble, here's $1.5 billion, we are willing to give you this if you could now give us some sort of programme for government. Stephen, we were told right the way through that period between February 22 when the Assembly came down and February this year when it was up again, we were told that the parties were having talks facilitated by the head of the civil service, by people from various departments, that they were discussing the priorities, they were discussing the finances, they were discussing what needed to be done when the executive was set up again. It's set up again, Stephen, and apparently they're having exactly the same conversations because nobody made any decisions then, and I don't expect them to make any decisions now.
Alex, very few people listening to this programme will have heard of this guy called Andrew McCormick. So I want to give a wee bit of background to Andrew. He was trusted in the civil service. It's Dr. Andrew McCormick is his name. He was trusted in the civil service. He was the very high ranks of it. He spent his career in it. And he would be, I think it's fair to say, he would be protective and respectful of the many colleagues that he had across the board in the civil service. So yesterday when I was sitting in this studio, and when I asked him a simple question, Alex, does our executive have credibility with the Treasury? With a guy with his temperament, which is usually calm and he's considered, he nearly choked when I even asked the question. Have a listen.
It's a real serious dilemma, and they need to face up to these issues and, you know, work it out and get to a place of credibility with the Treasury in London. That's
Do you think it lacks credibility
base.
At the moment?
Yes, I nearly choked there. look at all that's happened.
Why? Why does Stormont lack credibility with the Treasury? Why?
Because they are keep asking for money, and Treasury says, "Well, can you make some contribution?"
Alex, he nearly choked. That's not funny, Alex. A guy of his temperament nearly chokes when I ask a simple question about credibility.
Well, if you look back, Steve, Andrew would belong to that generation of younger than me, maybe a decade or so, but that generation which remembers Northern Ireland being governed without devolution. It remembers that most of the decisions were made by the NIO, and the cooperation between the NIO and senior civil servants worked reasonably well. And yes, there were decisions which were put off simply because they kept saying, oh, we'll have to make joint decisions about this. But they kept the country running over at very difficult times. And certainly, I'm sure if you talk to Andrew and other people of that generation, you know, when devolution came in 25 years ago, I think the general expectation that, yes, there would be a steep learning curve for the civil service generation who had never worked in a devolved system, but also for all these political representatives who had never known, had never been in any form of government before. 25 years on, Stephen, we should have not only, you know, crested that steep curve, we should actually have been in a position where we're in a level playing field with the civil service, the NIO, the executive, the assembly are working collectively together and strong enough, cooperative enough, and trusting of each other enough. See, we should not be in a position where, you know, you have what representatives of four parties sitting in an executive who must know, Stephen, the challenges facing the health service, education, the infrastructure, the economy. They must know what these priorities
could they,
are. Why can't they not actually make a
decision? What is the score? I go on 12 weeks holiday a year, right? So I'm not one to talk about holidays, and politicians are entitled to their holidays. But can you explain to me even the basics of how decisions have been able to be made? Is Stormont still on holiday? Are they all still abroad? Or what is the score? Where are they?
I think technically it's in recess. I think it might probably kickstart again next week. But I remember writing the piece back in February, you know, about this saying, they can't afford. I simply said they can't, given the what's likely to happen, they cannot afford to just close down for 5, 6, 7, or 8 weeks to, oh, well, everybody's away. They cannot afford, and they shouldn't have done the same. It's shaming them for doing it. And I know people say, oh, they need holidays and so on. Yeah, they do need holidays. They're entitled to relax. They're entitled to have a time to themselves. But if we're continuing to guess with 2 years of us in government, and then you have another couple of months where there's no government because people are on holiday, it is morally wrong, Stephen. It is politically wrong. And strategically, in terms of reaching out to the Treasury, in terms of looking at the priorities, in terms of the decisions still to be made, they should not have gone on that summer break.
So can we expect a decision next week? And the NIO are laying it out crystal clear here. Now, whether that's jostling or not, or negotiating with the political parties or not, who knows? But the NIO have said it to us this morning, the government stands ready to support the executive to deliver on their priorities as strategically as possible to ensure the full benefits of funding can be realised. And they've referred to the funding as a £3.3 billion financial package. So the NIO are essentially saying they were given £3.3 billion. That's up to them how they cut it up. That's consistent with what the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, has said. And the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, came here. There was no promise for more money. Here's the final question, Alex. Can this executive stand up next week, the week after, however much up to the line they bring it? Can they stand up and say there's no money, extra money for policing, health or education, but they hand pensioners who don't need it a winter fuel allowance?
No, they can't do that, Stephen. And the other thing they can't do is, you're right, there is money available sometimes. You know, you cannot, the simple rule of life, whether you go into a bank or anywhere you want to borrow money under any circumstance, whatever it is, you have to be able to persuade the people who are willing to, you know, maybe give you £1 billion, £1.5 billion, £2 billion. You have to persuade them how you're going to spend it, where you're going to spend it, and what the benefits for Northern Ireland collectively will be. The executive seems to me, and I don't want to be too cruel, the executive seems to me to be incapable of giving that collective answer, either to the NIO, to the Treasury, or even to the rest of us poor sod. And it's not just pensioners, people. There are a lot of people in all sorts of areas of life who are struggling right now. And most of them are just shrugging their shoulders and going, sure, it's never going to change. And what the executive and the parties don't realise, that the deeper that gets ingrained into the public psyche, that the government, your own government, is incapable of making decisions,
okay,
incapable of governing you, the more you end up with a government that isn't worth calling a government.
Jason St. Coleraine. Morning, Jason. Alex, thank
Good
you. Morning, Jason.
Thank you, Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
Yes. The Prime Minister has went back, that's Labour government, has went back on every promise they made. And I know they're making tough decisions. I can understand that. But our executive are making no decisions at all. Who's making the decisions so that the people will know what's happening about winter fuel payments?
That's what we're asking.
Happening. There's nobody making decisions in Northern Ireland at all. They're not doing it.
Jason, thank you. Anne Watson, what do you say to the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, the Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, who's in charge of this Winter Fuel Allowance budget? What do you say to the man?
That's the most important thing of all.
Sorry, say again, Anne, we didn't hear you there. Say again.
Get back to work and sort these things out. I am not a racist, but foreign aid is great. But I was brought up to believe that charity begins at home, and we need to start doing things for people here. And if the pensioners don't get that money, they think that the problems with the medical situation, they ain't seen nothing yet. Because older people will not be able to go out, they'll not be able to heat their houses.
Well, some terrible. Older people won't be able to, Anne, but others who do not need this money are going to pocket it anyway.
Well, I know it would be very hard to determine who's who and what's what, but I think that they should let people decide for themselves. And if they don't need it, say, we don't want it. How many of them is going to be prepared to do that?
If tough decisions are going to... the Prime Minister is saying tough decisions will be made in this budget in October. Is there any signalling from the Northern Ireland executive as to how tough the locally devolved decisions will be here in Northern Ireland. That's what I'm asking. And thank you for coming on this morning. Next, just how much influence do paramilitaries still have in Northern Ireland? Well, last week, the DUP MLA, Edwin Poots, was talking to the BBC's Darren Marshall after a series of racist attacks in South Belfast. Have a listen to what he said about paramilitaries.
You know, a number of these paramilitary organisations are little more than old men's clubs now. You know, they are not what they used to be.
Do you buy that, though? Because some of those organisations have an iron grip on some of those loyalist communities. Do you buy it that some of those racist attacks can happen without approval of leadership?
Certainly the more significant organisations in South Belfast, you know, are not active in that sense. But that's not to say that because loyalist paramilitaries are so subdivided now, that there isn't individuals from breakaways and factions that aren't involved.
Now, we thought that was a really interesting point that Eben Poots was making to Darren Marshall. Some paramilitary groups are not active. In other words, they're not really a threat. Professor Dominic Bryan is with us this morning. Good morning to you.
Morning,
Dominic.
Steve.
There's a new report from Queen's entitled Understanding the Persistence of Armed Paramilitary Groups in Northern Ireland. It's going to be released this morning, actually. So it's good timing we're talking to you. In the context of Edwin Poots saying lots of these groups, it's old men, they're not really active. Some groups, he said. What's your assessment in this report?
Well, firstly, Stephen, thank you. The report is from colleagues at the Ulster University and Queen's and from other organisations. And it comes about precisely because we have all been interested in how paramilitarism has evolved, given that we are now 30 years since the ceasefires. So I think Edwin Poots's point is a very good and interesting one. And partly what we're trying to do, and this I understand that people never think this quite helps, is say, look, this is quite complicated. Because as social groups, some of these paramilitary areas have developed in one direction and others in another direction. So when Edwin Poots says he thinks broadly some of these are, old boys groups, I think they're a bit more than that, because a lot of them are involved in a lot of very positive community leadership and have been for some time. However, in the same organisations, there can be areas where groups are stuck, where there is still high levels of coercive control and high levels of illegality. And one of the problems we have in developing policy is both of those developments are true at the same time.
So is there any new ground in this report that is coming out, I think, at 10:30 today? Is there anything shifting in Northern Ireland that's significant with regards to paramilitaries?
What we're trying to do is create, if you like, a model of what paramilitaries are. We're asking a very fundamental question of what sort of social groups they are. And we're pointing out that they have a great deal of legitimacy in our society. So people support them. They do work in their local communities. Now, some of that's legal and some of that's illegal. We can come back to that problem in a minute. They get legitimacy from people like academics and media reporters and shows like yours and from politicians meeting them. And they have legitimacy from having a history and being embedded in families in Northern Ireland. They also provide sorts of services and utilities. Now, some of those are illegal, anything from money lending and drugs. Some of those are very positive. And thirdly, that they have levels of coercive.
What do you mean
control?
Positive? What's positive about it? Positive about lending money lenders?
No. So I'm saying that some of the services they offer have been positive in some areas. I'm absolutely not saying money lending,
like
drug
what?
Dealing.
What services do these gangsters provide that's positive?
But what's interesting and important is that they often fill a space where there is a level of need. And this is where we get to the crux of it. When they do that in society, when they do that in areas, they get a level of legitimacy. In some senses, they're sort of replacing the work the state should be doing.
All right. And this is how they have some often a powerful control in our society. So the question then comes is, how do you deal with that? And there's two options. One is the full policing option. One is the option that you are going to just make this as an act, a justice solution, if you like. The other, which can be quite controversial, is community development. So you're working within the communities to lift them up, all right, so that the space in which the paramilitaries offer these, and I'm putting this in inverted commas, services, becomes smaller. And that's the real policy challenge when you're looking at the change process that is taking place.
Stay there for me. The SDLP Councillor Carl White is joining us this morning. Morning to you, Carl.
Morning, Stephen. Morning, Dominic.
As is Alison Morris, morning. Crime Correspondent, Belfast Telegraph. Morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. The stats that we've got, we just got these, I think, yesterday from the police. It talks, Carl, it speaks to how much power these paramilitaries still have. Policing Crime Task Force, Paramilitary Crime Task Force, up until July 2024, almost £6.5 million has been recovered from controlled drugs. 409 weapons and firearms have been seized, 495 arrests, almost 1.2 million of cash has been seized, 2.36 million of property, Carl.
Yeah, I think those are stark statistics, Stephen, and if that's what's been successfully secured by police activity, imagine what the police haven't detected, and the other drugs that haven't been confiscated, cash that hasn't been found, which was sourced through completely illegal activities. I think we need to be very clear here, and a lot of respect for Dominic. I've worked with him on Flags Commission and the people behind this report. But we need to be very clear that using terms like legitimacy in the broad way they're being used in this report, that doesn't stand up to any scrutiny. They are not legitimate. They don't have any legitimacy. These organisations are prescribed by the UK government under the Terrorism Act 2000. Now, that you don't get a prescription under the Terrorism Act 2000 for, you know, being a bold boy or a bold girl. This is for serious terrorist activity, national security, a risk to national security, and the idea as well that, you know, need a policing response or a community development response. We've had a community development response for paramilitary groups for the last 20 years, and it has failed. And the statistics that you've just read out are evidence that it has failed. I think Edwin Poots's comments, and I think someone with Edwin Poots said, you know, you have to, he is an experienced politician, whether we disagree, I disagree with him on a lot of things. But I think that comment was particularly ill thought out. It doesn't reflect the reality in other areas of Northern Ireland.
Well, Alison Morris, what's your experience when Poots is saying that some of these paramilitary groups, they're old men, and what he essentially means is they're no threat. Is he right, Alison?
Well, both things can be true. So what has happened is loyalism is incredibly fractured. It's not one group anymore. There's not one UDA or one UVF. They have fractured into various, UDA more so than the UVF, into various sort of almost little fiefdoms, tiny little gangs. And some of those have decided that they want nothing more to do with it, and they have went in their own terms. What they do to me is gone home. They took nothing more to do with it, and they're now old men, as he said, their grandfathers, and they're just getting on with their lives, but they do show up at commemorations and things like that. Apart from that, they're completely inactive. There's no threat to the state or to the communities that they live in. Then there's other parts of those organisations have morphed into organised crime gangs, and very effective organised crime gangs, because they maintain the structures of a paramilitary group, so those sort of military-type structures, but also they have continued to recruit.
And is that whole organisations, Alison, or is that, you know, I'm talking here UDA, UVF, and so goes on,
yeah,
or is it parts of them, splinter groups of them?
Yeah, it's parts of them. So there's parts of the UDA. If you look, for example, up in and around Lisburn, there has been no punishment beatings, punishment shootings, anything like that. And they have, in effect, morphed into not an old boys club even as such, but a sort of active community organisation that no longer has the structures of the UDA nor recruits nor anything along those lines. Then you look at somewhere like the South East Antrim UDA, and they're just a huge organised crime gang. you know, there's no political or a purpose to them anymore, no community purpose. They're just an organised crime gang. And also, a lot of this community transformation work is incredibly lucrative, and you have to remember that. There's millions of pounds being pumped into this, and a lot of this goes to people who are former prisoners and who have served time for some very serious crimes, and they now are paid by the state as part of this transformation work, and the transformation never happens. Because why would it? Because if you're being paid to transform for transitioning and to disappear, well, as soon as you disappear, the money stops. So why would you disappear?
So the
whole thing is self-fulfilling. They keep on. I think that the approach to this has been completely wrong. And I do think that those parts of those organisations that are old boys clubs that have morphed into that need to come out and say, we are entirely separate. This is what we do.
Does your report look, Dominic, at the likes of the South East Antrim UDA who are involved in criminality very openly, very blatantly?
No, we have not specifically looked at any group. It was not our task to try and look narrowly at the different groups, because Alison's description, I think, is quite right. So I don't think we needed more research to know what journalists like Alison have produced. I think that's right. I think the question is, how do we examine a way forward when we're dealing with that diversity? So I do think some community development work has worked. I do think some of these organisations, in parts, have moved on, whilst I'm also sympathetic with Carl's position that we shouldn't be offering these groups legitimacy. And what we're hoping to do is try to create a model which means that you can make decisions about whether a particular group in a particular area has significantly moved on, and offering that group support.
But do we not need to be different. Specific about the groups then? You have deliberately, in looking at this report, not focused down in the groups. Does someone not need to start distinguishing between these different groups?
Well, that's the policy question. That's the difficult thing. We're trying to provide a model to say, to be blunt, whether you could score. We look at the services provided, we look at the threat that they give to people, and we look at the legitimacy they have, and in a way we could provide a scorecard to look at who's moving on.
Sorry, Alison?
It's actually not that difficult. It's actually quite simple. I mean, I could give you a list now of organisations that are happily involved in criminality and others that have morphed or disappeared, or you know, show up at a commemoration once a year.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. The police know who they are. You know, I know who they are. Most people know who they are. The level of coercion that still exists is something that I think that by discussing it in the way we do, you probably can give legitimacy to.
Okay.
And also, remember, there are people here seen standing, you know, with senior police officers one day, and then they might be intimidating someone from the home.
We've got to leave it there. Dominic, Alison, Carl, thank you very much. The News. Morning, everyone. Don't forget, if you're contacting The Nolan Show with a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk. Our podcast runs every day. You can listen to the programme whenever suits you on BBC Sounds. You'll have been hearing in the news how more than 400 Muslim women from across Northern Ireland have written to the Education Minister. They're frightened about their kids coming back to school after the racism that we've seen, the riots that we've seen on our streets. Naomi is one of those mothers who have signed the letter. Naomi, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're a mum of four.
Yes.
How frightened are you about the safety of your children?
I think, my youngest went off to primary school today. They're in a great wee school, very small school, which has a very positive ethos about difference. I think it's more concerning for my older child, because she's in secondary school, and the secondary schools, there's a lot less of a bubble of protection there. And there were some protests near to where she goes to school. And there's always the concern that some of the kids who were at the protests were involved with will also be at school with her. And you can't control that.
And did she see some of the children in her school at the protests?
We didn't. I know that there was some there. She personally didn't. I didn't really. When all this kicked off, we didn't really want our kids to see it.
Sure.
So we haven't talked about it much in their presence because we don't want them to be scared. I think it's something the parents have been protecting their children a lot. But I know a friend of mine has seen one of the more famous videos. She knew the child involved because they're actually at school with her. There have been some direct people identify that they go to school with our children, and that's worrying from both. It's depressing as well.
Is the concern that your child may be attacked on the way home from school? Is that what's in your head?
That's one of the things. I'll be picking up my daughter at the school gate all year, I think. But there's a lot of concerns about buses. There's always been issues with bullying in Northern Irish schools. I know people have been bullied for various things, but anti-Muslim bullying has been an issue for a long time, and some schools have not been very good at addressing it. And so we're already on the back of that. And then if kids have been more exposed to the kind of dehumanising narratives about Muslims, that they're here to, you know, harm people or whatever, people are worried now about even if their husbands are leaving children to school, are they going to get comments, you know, because they're men? Are kids who wear headscarves going to get comments, or kids because of their names, because of their religion?
And do you think they are, or has it all quietened down again?
I think this hasn't gone away. I mean, I think the drama's gone away. Like, obviously, there's no riots and there's been quite a strong police response, but the underlying sentiments haven't gone away. Those haven't been addressed. They haven't been challenged critically. And there needs to be some really difficult conversations to challenge some of the stereotypes and the misconceptions that are out there, because they're just going to fester. You can suppress this kind of thing for so long, but it's going to fester, and it's going to bubble up in places like the school playground, the school bus. Kids who have heard stuff over the summer.
How old are your children, Naomi?
My youngest is 5, so I have a 5, 7, 11 and 12.
And has your 11 and 12-year-old, I'm asking about them because presumably, you know, they're at the age now where they could understand it, they could convey it back to you. Have they experienced racism?
Yes.
What type? What's happened to them?
It started when they're very young, to be honest, because I also wear the headscarf. So we've had comments like "go home," swear words while we're in the park. So they've experienced this personally when they're out with me. Obviously, the places of worship have been, the mosque that they attended had been targeted in the past. On the day, you know, when the riots were breaking out across the UK, my daughter had an appointment, and I had to give her basically a, because I had protected her, suddenly explain what's going on, because we were in the waiting room and it was all on the news, and some of the interviews, like the comments that they were hearing on the news from people about Muslims, like she was hearing that for the first time from the news. So I had to sort of have a talk with her and tell her that this has been happening. They've seen it in real life, and they've also seen it in the media as well.
But have they experienced it in the playground?
No, they've been quite lucky in the primary school. No, my daughter has had one or two comments in the secondary school, but overall, she's been quite safe. Because she wears a headscarf, there's been a lot of misconceptions about, I mean, that's her choice. I talked her through it and said you don't have to wear it, but she was very, very keen to wear it when she started, and so she has had some comments about that.
And have the school tackled it? Have the pupils that said it to her been tackled?
Her school's been good. She didn't want to go any further with it. We talked it through, but the school overall has been quite welcoming of people of difference, which is good. But I have friends who have, unfortunately, the school just denied it happened, and you know, so I think I personally have been quite lucky, but I have other friends that really haven't.
The school ignored it? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been in the past, people just, kids, they just don't get on, you know, kind of downplaying this kind of thing as if it's, just kids being mean to each other. It happens. So there's definitely been a lot of that in the past in some schools. It's not one. It doesn't matter what the reason is, but you know, I think generally with bullying in schools, there's been a lack of understanding. But it's sometimes it's not even just the it's not even just the pupils. I mean, there's been comments made by teachers. Like last year, for example, someone had said that girls in the Middle East don't get an education, which is, my daughter's one of the top pupils in her year. Not boasting, but just pointing out. And it's not true. You know, obviously there's an awful situation in Afghanistan, but that doesn't apply to every other country. So there's generalisations sometimes are being pushed by teachers as well.
So what do you think the Education Minister, Paul Given, can do about this year?
Well, they've given quite a comprehensive reply. Just yesterday we got it, and really have to work through it. But a lot of it seems to be on the basis of the existing anti-bullying, which would be great to see that implemented. And then it seems to be really down to individual schools to ensure that they have education, like awareness of programmes within the different schools. So that the nature of schooling in Northern Ireland, obviously you can't impose things on schools. So it's really up to schools to take the initiative to talk about anti-racism and to talk about anti-Muslim hate specifically, because so much of this has been driven, and anti-asylum seeker narratives as well, because a lot of that has been driven behind a lot of this. So they have different things in place and Safer Schools app and stuff that they've told us about, which is good and it is reassuring. But I think we'll just have to wait to see how this year plays out, and how incidents are dealt with and reported.
Naomi, thank you very much. Important that we hear from you this morning. Thank you for talking to us today. Brian's in Belfast. Morning, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen. I'm just referring back to your comments and Edmund Poot's comments on the paramilitary report.
Yeah,
I've always said I wish the media and politicians would delete the word from their minds, paramilitary. They are not paramilitaries. They are now gangsters. And that's saying it would solve a lot of problems, but it would hit home to these people that they're giving them, they're putting on a wee pedestal because they're paramilitaries.
Do you think they don't know what they are already?
They do know. I mean, the people who live within the areas, the decent people, know that, and they can't speak out too much about it.
There's a contradiction, though, Brian, in some of the messaging from society around this, because when there is a lot of trouble in a local community, it is sometimes the paramilitaries who are approached to ask them if they can calm things down. Like, it wouldn't be the first time that the police, for example, would contact so-called community leaders who have paramilitary connections. So the police talk to these people.
Yeah.
And indeed, even during the recent riots, there were questions being asked of some of the paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland if they could have any influence and stop the rioting. So once you give them their place, you can't give them their place sometimes and not others. It's either they're gangsters, full stop, that's the consistent message, or not.
Well, Stephen, I mean, I do remember people going to paramilitaries, even where I come from. But those instances and days are gone now. That doesn't really, really happen, to be honest with you. And another thing about the media, Stephen, what we read in the papers this last few days and weeks about these attacks on homes and businesses, this is not the far right doing this here. This is, well, I'll use the word far militaries, but you know where I'm coming from. These are the gangsters who are doing this, who say they're paramilitaries. These are the people who are doing this.
Okay. You know. Brian, thank you very much. Morning to you. Spiders next. If you have a fear of them, how many of them are coming into your... I'm fighting them all over my house and I'm terrified of these things. We're now approaching spider season where these spiders want to mate in your houses. Apparently one of the largest spiders, it can grow to the size of a rat. Now, I keep on saying this. Surely to goodness a spider can't grow to the size of a rat. If I saw one of those, I would absolutely wet myself. And what I need to understand about this, it's being reported that the fen raft spider, which can grow to the size of a rat and hunts fish, a spider, is in Great Britain, but isn't coming to Northern Ireland. I wonder, is it blocked with the Irish Sea border? Does it have to fill in paperwork, this spider, before it comes here? Paul Moore is an entomologist, works as a consultant for pest control companies. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning, Stephen.
Tell me about this Fenrir spider.
Well, how big a rat can a rat be? You know, you've got baby rats, you've got big, large rats. So it's all in the... It's to grab people's attention. Whenever they heard about raft spider, that was another thing too. You know, these things float around the surface of the water, surface tension, they don't sink below it, but will take out small fish, tadpoles,
what?
Other insects.
A spider?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they don't spin a web. They simply run around the surface of the water and then dip in, grab a tadpole, immobilize it, and eat it. So, that, you know, but they're small.
Though, never mind about the tadpole. I want to know what this spider could do to me if it's in my house.
Well, you're not going to get those here at all. They don't fly unless some evil entomologist decided to pick some up from England and bring them over here.
But why are they in England and not here? Is it anything to do with the Irish Sea border and Brexit?
No, they're only fired by five sites now. Now you're stretching things. Yeah, that's a political question you need to answer the politicians about. That's something else.
I'm joking. The list. Yes.
Yeah.
But why are they? Seriously, why are they across the water and not here? I don't understand.
Well, we do have raft spiders here, but a lot smaller. They're only found in five sites over in England at the moment, and people are actually breeding them over in England and translocating them from one place to another under license. Yeah, I know. Well, that's ecology for you. People are trying to biodiversify things and spread these things out because they're good for the ecology. That's what they're saying. They control other creatures.
Talk me through how these spiders live. So when they're in my house or anybody else's house, and we're seeing a lot more of them in the summer, why are we seeing more of them in the summer?
There's not more insects about the place. Do you have spider webs in the house?
Well, not when I try to clean them, but the last time I tried to clean the house, I fell on my back and wrecked my ribs. It's another story.
Well, that's another dangerous thing about spiders. Don't go after them. They have these little notions that they'll cast spells on you if you're not careful and make you fall over. But spiders have been around, you know, and they're in their houses all the time anyway, but you don't notice them coming in the winter time or autumn time. You're in the house more, you're sitting watching TV or reading a book, and that's when you notice the spider. So it's a psychological sort of thing. You know, you're there, they're there all the time, but you don't notice them until you're in the house more. It's the same with wasps. You don't see wasps in the summertime unless it's good weather and you're having a barbecue, and that's when you get affected by the wasps. But they're out there all the time anyway.
Can a spider, like, how dangerous is a bite from a spider? Nobody I'm always terrified died. When I'm sleeping at night and these things crawling all over me.
They won't crawl. They're afraid of you. They're more afraid of you.
I hear this all the time, but the spiders... Oh, and then they trap the wee insects. You see the insects in the webs.
Yep. And they inject venom into a poison. And that kills off the prey very quickly. It also liquefies the insides of it, and then they suck the juices out through the skin of the insect.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so, and you're left with a perfect piece of insect to identify later on. But all insects are venomous. They're not poisonous. If you swallowed one, you wouldn't die from it unless it actually bit a blood vessel or something. That's how the poison gets around. But we have no danger spiders in Ireland, okay? The one that could give you a bite is something called a woodlice spider. And it's got big pincers. It eats woodlice, slaters, and it rips them apart with its jaws. And if they can give you a nip, you would feel it, and they could be infected with something from under.
Are they here?
The logs and stone. Oh, yeah, they're here. They're a big, an orangey-red one. It's quite a big beastie. It's a quite stocky beastie.
No.
You would know it. You would know it if you saw it. Oh. You know, it's got big fangs on it, really big, obvious fangs.
No.
Whereas most of the other spiders have got small fangs, and they wouldn't even penetrate your skin.
So are there any tips as to how to keep these things out?
Well, if you don't want any insect or spiders about you, live in a glass bubble. That's all you can do. But practically, keep your doors and windows closed this time of year. Put bristle strips, you know, the things for keeping drafts out. Put those under your doors as well, because they'll slip under doors. The climb up windows, no problem at all. Climb up glass quite easily. Generally, keeping your doors closed is the best thing. But they're in your house already, unfortunately. Now, you can use these sort of remedies, you know, chestnut oil, lavender, cinnamon, all that sort of thing. But
does that work?
Not really, no. And don't go for the sonic vibration things. You know, these things you plug in and sounds like a sonic noise.
I bought those for mice in the past, and I had more mice after I plugged them in than before.
It attracts it, unless you can pick it up and throw it at the damn thing. It's not going to do any good at all. You know, they're a money spinner for some people, and I've checked the research on these things all over the world, and none of these sonic things work at all. They're just a money spinner, so they are.
Well, you've been no good today. You've given me no advice as to how to keep these hairy things out.
Keep your doors closed. Don't go outside. Check your laundry, because it can be on your laundry line as well, sitting waiting, and then you bring them in your laundry. I'm not trying to panic here, I think, but you know, you can just got to appreciate the things. You know,
I do not appreciate them. Absolutely not. I appreciate a spider. I want them nowhere near me.
Well, I said there's been nobody killed by spiders in the UK. There are some foreign spiders coming in, but the ones we have here are all harmless. More people die from bee or wasp stings than are killed by spiders.
From what?
Stuff. Bees and wasps. Bees and wasp stings.
Oh, they're not coming too, are they?
Well, no, they're here now. I mean, ordinarily, a honeybee can kill somebody if they're, you know, allergic to the poison. And wasp sting will be all the time too. And
I'm terrified of those. Terrified.
You should be an entomologist. You'll appreciate the things more. Yeah. From an early stage. When I was five, I was collecting bees and wasps for dear sake.
Yes. Well, that's.
But that's me. I'm weird. Okay.
Exactly. All right, you weirdo. Self-confessed weirdo. Thank you, Paul. Yep. Good morning. Goodness sake. James in Temple Patrick. Good morning, James.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
You're very good at criticising what the government and what the Astronomers Assembly never do, but you never come up either with a programme or with some suggestions on how to raise money.
I'm not running the country.
Well,
they are.
Stephen, yes, but if we keep talking about the problems and never talk about the solutions, we'll never go anywhere. So here's a couple of simple examples. Why don't we have a higher rate of MOT charge for people with bigger cars? Why do we give discount on parking tickets when people are breaking the law? Why don't we start thinking differently about raising money rather than just the constantly hitting the pensioners?
Well, all we're asking is, what's the decision on the pensioners? That's all we're asking, James.
Stephen, as somebody who has the biggest show in the country, why don't you start thinking about offering some of the biggest solutions that we can have that actually then you can direct or at least give Stormont some assistance in coming up with some solutions rather than tax, tax, tax. There are other ways of doing this, and we just need to think differently. And all we ever do, we talk about the problems, we never talk about the solutions.
So what would you do?
Well, certainly there's two examples. I would say people who say who have cars over 2 litres should pay double the MOT fee. With, say, 500,000 cars, that's probably 3, 4, 5 million pounds straight away. Would I give discount to people who get a parking ticket if they pay it early? No, I wouldn't. Why should I? You break the law, you pay your fine. There's another probably 5, 6, 10 million pounds. It's all these small amounts that will add up that don't affect people who are struggling with the cost of living. They affect people who have the money.
What do you mean? People who are struggling with cost of living get parking tickets for a start.
Well, then they shouldn't be parking where they shouldn't do, should they?
Right.
It's a choice.
Okay. James, thank you very much. Last story of the day. Taxi drivers have contacted this programme, hitting out what they say is a lack of traffic warden enforcement of a taxi rank in Belfast City Centre. Pat, you're a taxi driver. Morning to you.
Morning, Stephen.
What's the problem?
Stephen, the problem is the taxi rank in Warring Street. Holly covered this, I think, in April while you were away in Las Vegas. And it hasn't improved any. It hasn't changed. And weekend there, busy bank holiday weekend, we couldn't get on the taxi rank to carry out our business. Our guys had to go up the curb at the other side of the taxi rank on double yellow lanes. And guess what? The police came along and told them to move, or they'd give them tickets. We can't get on our place of work, Stephen. We need help. We've already asked. I've tried umpteen times. I've emailed the department. I've tried to get telephone calls. There's nobody within that department will take ownership of the enforcement of taxi ranks. I spoke to one of the guys at the traffic warden's office. They hadn't even got Warring Street on their daily walk until your show got in contact with them. and at that,
what?
They can come round.
I know of no street where the taxi wardens aren't on their daily walk.
Well, your show can confirm because
I went in to get a wee chicken, a wee chicken wrap the other day. Taxi ride, two of them, traffic wardens.
Yes, well, Warren Street wasn't on their walk. One of the busiest streets in Belfast wasn't on their walk until your show contacted them and they put them in. Now, if they come round, it's once. If they ticket the cars that are on their rank, Stephen, it makes absolutely no difference to our drivers. They can't get on their rank. We cannot get on our place of work. We need something sorted out. This has gone on this last year.
You see, your problem, Mr. Pat, is I have the figures. Department for Infrastructure have told the Nolan Show since the 9th of April of this year, there have been a further 55 traffic ticket, parking tickets issued on Waring Street to vehicles parked on a taxi rink during the hours of restriction, which is 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. So they've handed out 55 parking tickets, to be fair, since
right,
April.
So to be fair, Stephen, work that out. 7 nights a week by many, did you say 55? There's 6 taxi spaces there. So a week, that's not even one a day, Stephen. Work out how many days it is.
You're saying you can't do your job, basically.
Can't do your job. We can't. Now, I spoke to that guy the night times are, Michael Stewart. He said to me, Pat, nobody cares about taxi ranks. I've tried to ask them. Nobody cares. So what are we to do, Stephen? How are we meant to provide
a
service?
Michael said that now, that nobody cares. I doubt it.
Ask Michael. Michael went and checked. He checked with the city council. He checked with various other people. And Michael's words to me were, Pat, nobody cares. I've tried. I'm banging my head against the wall. Nobody cares. So people are crying out.
All right. So he was trying to help, but nobody
yes,
he talked
Michael
to
was trying to help as well. But Stephen, we're trying to provide a service. People are crying out. There's no taxis in Belfast. Our taxis can't get on to provide a service. And like the police will come along, move our cars from WL lanes, but they won't move the gangs who are parking a taxi rank because it's not within their remit.
Well, who's parking in these taxi ranks?
It must be patrons of bars. It could be bar staff. It could be, you know, we don't know. But it's if you look at the picture, Stephen, that our drivers are putting up on Twitter, and I know they've got you included in it, it's the same registrations every single night of the week that are parking there. And, you know, if they're getting a fine, they must be earning good money, Stephen, if they can afford to constantly park in a taxi rank and get a ticket. And if the traffic wardens are doing the job that they say they're doing, those people would be fed up parking there because they'd be getting a ticket all the time. It's not happening all the time, Stephen.
Department for Infrastructure, currently Waring Street's not included in the traffic attendant evening patrols.
There you are, thank you.
However, there have been 61 notices issued on Waring Street to vehicles parked between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. I don't even understand that. It's not included in evening patrols, but they've handed out 61 tickets during the night.
Because your show got in contact with them and they started telling them to walk around. It wasn't until the Nolan Show, Stephen, got in contact with them. They weren't doing anything. The only people that tried to help us is your show.
I think they're going to have additional enforcement. Look at that. Additional enforcement. I can be asked for, they say. All right, Pat, thank you very much. That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
In the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.